I'm going to try to get Tracy Hall to tell a story of his man-made diamonds for the family. He has the flu today and is home from work, and that is why his voice will sound hoarse.
Adderosa's statement was made yesterday. Today's the 21st, and I think she's finally cornered me, and I might have to do what she wants me to do. In October of 1948, we accepted a position as a research associate at the General Electric Company in Schenectady, New York. During September, I had considered several job opportunities, had traveled to Rochester, New York, to talk to the Eastman Kodak people, had talked to Hercules Powder Company people, Allegheny Ballistics Lab in Cumberland, Maryland, and had talked with DuPont people in Virginia, New Jersey, and Wilmington, and had also talked to people in the Bakelite Corporation, Boundbrook, New Jersey. Peculiar thing, all of these people wanted to give me a job, but General Electric didn't. As a matter of fact, when I had written to General Electric, they told me there's no point in coming to Schenectady for an interview. But I wrote to them and told them I was passing by anyway, and would it be all right if I stopped off? They reluctantly said okay, so I did stop off, and I apparently didn't make too good an impression with the man who headed the chemistry department, Abraham Lincoln Marshall, and with other officials, but did make a real good impression with a fellow by the name of Cass, William Cass, who at that time seemed to be up and coming in chemistry department and was assisting in a lot of their recruiting activities. Cass told me at the time he didn't think that the management was giving me a fair shake, but he was sure going to try and convince them that they ought to hire me. I had wanted to work for General Electric all my life. I can remember when I was a grade school student in approximately the fourth grade at Marriott School in Weber County, Utah. My teacher at that time, Miss Beulah Stallings, who taught grades 3, 4, and 5 all in the same classroom, had asked the students what they wanted to be when they grew up. I told her I wanted to be an electrical engineer and work for General Electric. Well, it turned out that although I dabbled in areas related to electrical engineering and actually spent time as a radar officer in the Navy, having had training at Bowdoin College, MIT, Harvard, and other places in electronics, it turned out that when I went back to school after World War II, I returned to chemistry and obtained a PhD in that field. Well, after this interviewing trip, I returned back to Salt Lake City and waited for offers. I pretty soon had offers from all the companies except General Electric. I kept waiting and hoping to hear from General Electric. Finally wrote to them or called to them, and they said they were still considering things. Finally, a phone call to the chemistry department came to me from Schenectady, New York. At the time, I happened to be in the library, and the call somehow was transferred over there. Glenn W. Giddings, who at that time was the recruiter for the research lab of the General Electric Company, was on the phone and told me that they were offering me a job at $6,200 a year. I later learned that my counterparts who were being hired at this same time, who were graduating from Princeton and Harvard and MIT and Yale, were being offered $5,700 a year. I attribute the differential to the fact that I was a few years older, had served in the war, and also had received a tremendously good recommendation from Henry Eyring. I had been interested in inorganic systems, having done part of my thesis work on the isomers of chromic salts, and wanted to continue to pursue some work in this field. General Electric, in spite of the fact that they had said a fellow could do anything that he wanted on coming to the search laboratory, soon was trying to push me into areas of practical interest to the company. I contended that there might be some interest in inorganic polymers of chromium or aluminum or other things that we might work on. They definitely weren't interested in having me pursue this sort of thing. It is interesting, however, that as years went by, there was a point when they asked me if I wouldn't like to work in the inorganic polymer area. This was at a time when I'd become interested in other things, and of course at that point did not want to. The first work of significance that I did in the research laboratory was in connection with polytrifluoroethylene materials. These materials nowadays are known by the trade name Cal-F. The company was interested in finding a solvent for these particular polymers in order that they might be coated on wire by evaporation of the solvent, and for other reasons. Also, there was no way to measure molecular weight of these materials because there was no solvent for them. I was able to make a study of the solubility of these polymers from a theoretical point of view after having read a book on solubility by Hildebrand. Also, I discovered that the quantity known as the solubility parameter was the thing that would determine solvents for this material, and that materials that had solubility parameters around those of carbon tetrachloride would act as solvents. Now, it turned out that the polymer could only be dissolved at an elevated temperature. It would not dissolve in carbon tetrachloride at any temperature to which carbon tet could be subjected at room pressure, but I discovered that by putting carbon tet under pressure, I could get to a high enough temperature to readily dissolve the polymer. And by this means, I was able to select from available organic solvents the other materials that would dissolve the polymer. I wrote this article up for one of the scientific journals. It happened to be reviewed by Hildebrand before publication, and he wrote a nice letter to me commending me on fine piece of scientific research involved that was of practical interest. This buoyed my ego a great deal at that point in my life. I continued to work on various aspects of this polymer, measured its molecular weight by a light scattering technique at elevated temperatures under moderate pressure. And I also did other things. There's a point where they were interested in the cut through of wires that were coated with this particular polymer. Along in 1951, Chauncey Guy Suits, the director of research for the company, decided that it was time for the research laboratory to take a look at the synthesis of diamonds. Zay Jeffries of the Carbaloy Company had, before World War II, been interested in this problem, and he and others in the company had solicited the help of Percy Bridgman in trying to synthesize diamonds. This was a joint venture with the Carborunda Company and the Norton Company. As I understand it, $100,000 was spent without success. A lot of the money was spent for a special hydraulic press that was that later ended up in the Norton Company, where they proceeded to continue the research. The problem was placed in the mechanical investigations section of the chemistry department. A.L. Marshall was head of the chemistry department. A.J. Tony Nerad was manager of the mechanical investigations department. At this time, I was in the physical chemistry department under Liebhofsky, Hermann Liebhofsky. Two of the physicists in the mechanical investigation section, Herbert M. Strong and Francis P. Bundy, were asked to survey the literature to see what others had done. They spent approximately a year in conducting this survey. At this point, they issued a report to the company management of what had been done and outlined some procedures that might be followed in some new attempts based on the use of some of Bridgman's high-pressure equipment. At this point, company officials decided they should have two chemists working on the project. The physical chemists and inorganic chemists in the company were called into a meeting where the proposed problem was discussed, and the question was asked as to who among these chemists might be interested in working on the project. I was the only one that was interested. The rest of the men considered working on diamonds to be a crackpot venture in view of the long crackpot history of scientists working on diamonds for over 100 years. Since I was the only one interested, I got the job. At this point, I thought I was still working for Liebhofsky, and Liebhofsky didn't know where I was working, and later on I learned that Tony Nerad figured I was working for him. But anyway, for some period of time, there was some uncertainty as to whether I was continuing to work in the physical chemistry section or in the mechanical investigation section. Later on, I believe about a year later, a second chemist, Robert Wentorf, who had just graduated from the University of Wisconsin, was also hired to work on the project. Now, during the early days of the project, I spent my time reading the scientific literature on what people had claimed to have done on diamonds, and doing some additional thinking about the problem. I say additional thinking because diamonds had interested me from the time I had worked on my master's degree at the University of Utah. At that time, I had read considerably in the old scientific literature about diamonds and had thought quite a bit about making diamonds or about making boron, a solid crystalline boron that I thought might be as hard as diamond. This was in the days when it was not certain that anyone had ever prepared pure boron, and certainly no one had prepared it in anything but an amorphous form at that time. The work seemed to divide itself into two natural categories. It was obvious that there was no high-pressure, high-temperature equipment available that would reach pressures and temperatures of the magnitude that might be necessary to synthesize diamonds. Also, it was apparent that it might not be possible to transform diamond directly, or transform graphite directly to diamond at the pressures and temperatures that we might be able to achieve. It might be possible to use a carbon-containing compound to produce diamond plus other products. Such a reaction might require a lower pressure and a lower temperature than would be required for the direct conversion from graphite. Also, there were questions about the rate of the reaction. Geologists had said hundreds or of thousands or millions of years to make diamonds in nature. And of course, if we're going to make them in the laboratory, we would only be interested in making them in a very rapid period. At that time, we thought maybe if you could grow a diamond in a couple of weeks, that might be all right. So one of the objectives was to devise high-pressure, high-temperature equipment that might get somewhere, say, in the neighborhood of 35,000 atmospheres and maybe a temperature of 1,000 degrees C or so. Then this would be a great step forward, and it might be possible to synthesize diamonds under these conditions. Now, it seemed that the logical men to work on the high-pressure equipment were the two physicists, Strong and Bundy, and they were given this assignment. Strong and Bundy had been working on what was known as the P0 project. This was a project to use vacuum as refrigerator insulation. Strong continued on this project for a while as Bundy went off onto the diamond project thinking about apparatus. Bundy came up with a device that was a modified version of a hollowed out anvil that Bridgman had described. Now Bridgman had worked with these flat anvils, and then in trying to increase his volume had hollowed out the anvils but had left the angles sharp. Now Bundy in a logical fashion rounded these sharp angles so that the stresses would be much more uniformly distributed. Bundy called this thing the saucer apparatus. Bundy has never published any details of this saucer device, but I described it in my General Electric Research Laboratory report, number RL-1064, which was published in March of 1954. This particular report was rigidly limited in its distribution within the General Electric Company. It was a Class 4 report, which was their highest secrecy category. This report, which was entitled The Belt, Ultra High Pressure High Temperature Apparatus, was finally released for publication in a journal in 1960. Well, Bundy's saucer was capable of reaching pressures of the order of 35,000 atmospheres simultaneously with temperatures of about 2,500 degrees centigrade. The working volume was extremely tiny. There was some indication that these pressures and temperatures should be high enough to convert graphite to diamond, but in practice this did not occur. Now, Bundy and Strong, together with their laboratory assistant Jim Cheney, Wentorf and I did not have an assistant. Strong and Bundy also had a second assistant, Hal Bovenkirk, who was working on the P-Zero project and later worked on the Diamond project. Strong and Bundy, on failing to make graphite go directly to diamond in the saucer apparatus, began to fiddle around with various chemical systems, which was supposed to be our assignment. After some time, they had no success with this and became discouraged, and at this point was possible for Wentorf and I to start using this equipment. Now, each of us who had been fooling around with various chemical systems tried these chemical systems under pressure without any success, and after a while we too became discouraged. At this point, it seemed like equipment that would reach still higher pressures and temperatures had to somehow be developed. Strong and Bundy had, for a long time, had an eye on the double-acting piston, I shouldn't say double-acting, I should say on the two-stage piston and cylinder device that Bridgman had used at pressures to 100,000 atmospheres. Now, the inner piston in this device of Bridgman's was only 1/16 of an inch in diameter, but at least it had been to these tremendous pressures, and Strong and Bundy thought that it wouldn't be too big of a job to scale up the size of this apparatus so that the inside piston were, say, something like 1/4 inch in diameter, and then heat the interior of this device in some manner, and thus get to higher pressures in a reasonably large system. Actually, the saucer system had much too tiny a volume, in addition to not getting to the desired pressures. Well, now, this two-stage piston device of Bridgman's would require what is known as a double-acting press for its operation, and it would require a rather large press, tonnage-wise, in order that the inner piston might have a diameter of the order of 1/4 inch or so. Well, this was talked about, and it was decided to buy such a double-acting press. This double-acting press was to cost something in the neighborhood of $150,000, and this was without Bridgman's two-stage piston cylinder device, which yet had not been designed in the larger size. Well, permission had to be obtained, at this time anyway, from the president of the company, to buy a piece of capital equipment for the research laboratory that cost more than $25,000. Well, permission was granted, the die was set, and things were to go this way. While the press was under construction, which was going to take a year and a half or two, Strong and Bundy were to design this two-stage piston and cylinder apparatus to be placed in the press at the time the press arrived. Well, this made a long wait ahead of us, and so we each went off working on other things. I know that Bundy was working on turbine bearings, as well as going back to additional work on the P-Zero project. I believe I continued some additional work on polytetrafluoroethylene, cut through on of insulation on wires, I believe. I also worked on a humidity control for basement dehumidifiers that were becoming popular at that time due to the humid condition that you have in basements in the eastern part of the country. In about December of 1952, while pondering the problem of an apparatus that might have a fairly large volume and get to higher pressures than Bridgman's or than Bundy's saucer apparatus, and trying to think of something that we might get into operation right away without waiting all this long period of time for this double-acting press, I came up with an idea for a device that was later known as the half belt. We did have a hydraulic press available. It was an old Watson-Stillman press that utilized water as the hydraulic fluid. This had been around the company for at least 30 years and was used in compressing powdered tungsten for the experiments that were being done to learn how to draw tungsten into wires. This particular press had a side ram on it as well as a regular ram that operated downward from above. This press was in terrible condition. Leaked water all over from the pullback rams that are located up on top and everywhere. Water just ran out from pipes everywhere. But this is the press that was being used to operate Bundy's saucer apparatus. Now, since I didn't have the calling to design apparatus, I approached Bundy with my idea. He was semi-enthused. At least he was willing to help me get it constructed. I did not have a shop order on which apparatus could be constructed, and you had to have a shop order to get work done in the GE machine shop. So this device, which I have described originally in this GE report number RL-1064, of which I have a copy, and which I've already mentioned, was later published in the Review of Scientific Instruments in 1960. Well, this device was built, worked quite well, I thought, although Bundy disagreed. He lost his enthusiasm completely about this device after we'd tried it out. And in his confidential reports to the boss, NERAD, he told him that it didn't hold any promise. Now, this device did have quite a bit larger volume than Bundy's saucer, and according to my test, could reach a higher pressure and a higher temperature. before I had actually constructed this particular device. In fact, I believe in February of 1953, I decided that this device could be double-ended, making the belt. Now, this thing was called a belt. It's kind of a code name, just a toroidal ring around the inner chamber gave it the name the belt. The half belt was just half of this device. It had a piston coming in, a tapered piston coming in from one end instead of two ends. Both of these devices were entirely different from Francis Bundy's device, because Bundy didn't think the half belt was any good. However, I could not receive permission to construct the full belt. Well, I stewed about this a little bit for a while, and finally decided that somehow I was going to have to take matters into my own hands and get this device belt, because from the analysis that I had performed and the new ideas that I had in this device, I could see that I could get a two-stage effect in a one-stage device. All of these things are described in the various publications that I have made down through the years. Of course, there was a period of 7 years of secrecy on these particular ideas of mine, which was very discouraging. Here was 7 years going by that I had had these ideas and had got them working, and I knew that there were leaks within the company of these ideas to the outside, and that eventually someone else was going to publish things along these lines, and I was going to be beat out on a development, an apparatus development, that was the culmination of 125 years of scientific effort in attempts to build apparatus that were suitable for synthesizing diamond. Fortunately, my fears were only partially realized. Even though the company waited until 1960 before letting me publish this, no one succeeded in beating me to publication on these particular ideas, although some people came pretty close, and I think the reason they did come close was because of being able to see pictures of the belt apparatus, which were given with a press release in 1955, although not in minute detail, also because of other leaks that there were within the company. Well, to get back to the belt apparatus, since the company wouldn't let me build it, I went to the machine shop and talked to the fellows down there that I knew real well by this time, and just asked them if they wouldn't build it. I didn't give them a shop order number. I just asked them if they wouldn't build it when they had slack time and weren't working on the things that Bundy and Strong wanted built. Well, this they did. Now, it took a long time. It took about 6 months, as I remember it, for them to complete my first belt apparatus made out of steel. Ida Rose, who is sitting here, asked me when they completed it. I don't know whether I have any record of that or not. I probably do in my GE notebooks. But, of course, the GE company has those in their possession. I have some 35 millimeter copies of the notebook, but they've deteriorated through the years, and I don't know whether they're any good at this point or not. At any rate, as I remembered, it was about 6 months, which would have placed this sometime around June or July of 1963 that I received the Belt apparatus from the shop. Well, during the time in which the Belt apparatus was being constructed, I obtained additional ideas as to how to increase its effectiveness. One of these ideas was to use a sandwich gasket. This is also described in my various publications. Now, I had broken the components to the half belt at this point, and so in order to try my sandwich gasket idea, I first tried it out in Bundy's saucer. Now, this increased the effectiveness of the saucer considerably and proved the point that this would work in any kind of a device using compressible gaskets. When I first told my associates about this sandwich gasket idea, they poo-pooed it. As a matter of fact, Herb Strong says it's no damn good, just like that. I paid no attention to them, though, and tried it out in Bundy's saucer apparatus, where it proved itself. So when I finally got my belt from the shop, I immediately incorporated the sandwich gasket idea into what later came to be called the flower pot gasket. Now, I was convinced right off that the belt apparatus was a good device. I immediately set about to try and find out the pressures that it would achieve by getting various transitions in the device that Bridgman had discovered in his flat anvils. Now, Bridgman's flat anvils worked on an extremely minute sample, could not be heated, but could obtain in a paper-thin sample about 3/8 of an inch in diameter pressures of 100,000 atmospheres. And in this minute apparatus, Bridgman had measured the electrical resistance of almost all the metals and had found sharp changes in electrical resistance in these things occurring at given pressures. And I was using these to try and find out how high a pressure my apparatus would go to. Well, I ran the bismuth transition and the thallium transition and so on. Now, I was quite convinced that in my steel apparatus I could get pressures somewhere around the order of 50,000 atmospheres, possibly higher. And of course, the volume was much larger than the volume in the saucer. And with the principles that I had at work here, I felt if I could only build the tapered pistons and the chamber out of tungsten carbide, I could get to the goal of 100,000 atmospheres in an apparatus that would be much simpler, much, much simpler than Bridgman's two-stage apparatus that Strong and Bundy were still thinking about but had not yet designed in a scaled-up version for the new press that was under construction. Well, now, although my colleagues and the boss were not willing to admit that the apparatus that I had at this point was any good. You see, they were definitely committed to this $150,000 press and this two-stage device of Bridgman's. Seeing me work kind of started giving them ideas too. And here at one point Herb Strong decided. Strong became interested in seeing if he couldn't use a piston and cylinder in a two-stage device, but in a somewhat simpler way than Bridgman had used it. Later on, he started to put a collar around the top of his piston that was composed of a sandwich gasket. It was a stack of pyrophilite rings alternating with steel rings. Well, this was exactly the sandwich gasket system that he had told me earlier was no damn good. But he never did refer to this as a sandwich gasket. He always called it a collar. And whenever any of us jumped him about this, and there were others besides myself, it always seemed to make him mad. No, it wasn't at all like Hall's sandwich gasket. This was a collar. Well, I'm getting a little bit ahead of the story here. But later on, Strong decided that this wouldn't work quite right either. So instead of having a straight circular cylinder, he made his cylinder tapered, just like the tapered piston that I had originally used in the half belt. Now, when he had a tapered piston, then he had to make his gasket flower pot shaped, just like mine, and again, it had alternating layers of steel and pyrophilite. It was a sandwich gasket, but still Strong kept calling it a collar. Well, he had now arrived at the point of development of my half belt, yet I had long since had the full belt working. Well, as he moved along, he experienced the same troubles with his half belt that I experienced with my half belt. He had cracking at the bottom of the chamber. And the only way to eliminate this cracking is to make a full belt out of it. Well, Strong didn't want to go quite all that way. He just always tried to seem to be following what I was doing, yet try and keep it different enough that he wouldn't exactly be duplicating what I was doing. So he finally made a belt, a full section belt chamber, but plugged up one end of it so that he only worked on it from one side like my half belt, so that he wouldn't have the trouble of the splitting at the bottom of the cylinder. Well, later on, to my amazement, Strong was able to get patents, independent of my own patents, on various versions of this half belt, which was obviously just a takeoff on the principles that I had developed many, many months before. Well, to get back to my story, I wanted to have the chamber and the pistons of the belt made out of tungsten carbide. Now, this would have cost about $1,000, or somewhere in that neighborhood, for the chamber and a couple of sets of pistons. Well, I wasn't getting anywhere. I couldn't convince my colleagues, at least they acted unconvinced, that I had anything. I always felt that they were trying to protect their own skins. They had committed to this vast sum of money to this double-acting press, and they weren't going to admit that a guy might have figured out a way to not have to use that big double-acting press. So I talked to my former boss, Liebhosky, who was running a seminar among the chemists in the physical chemistry group, and asked him if I could give a talk on some of my high-pressure developments. Now, theoretically, I shouldn't have done this. This project was very secret. Other people working in other sections, other groups, divisions within the research laboratory were not supposed to know about this. Well, I talked to Liebhosky and his group. They all enjoyed my talk immensely. And Liebhosky was very impressed, thought that I had a first-class development here. And so he talked to NIRAD and others, including Suits, and convinced them that I had something here that ought to be allowed to pursue. Well, subsequently, I did procure these components in tungsten carbide. Tungsten carbide, having a higher compressive strength than steel and being only one-third as compressible, will always allow you to obtain a higher pressure no matter what the apparatus is if you construct the vital components from this material. Well, I immediately was able to show that I could get now to truly high pressures. I obtained the cesium transition, no doubt being the first man to obtain this transition after Bridgman had succeeded in discovering it. I obtained the barium transition, which at that time was thought to occur at 77,400 atmospheres. We now know that it comes at 59,000 atmospheres, but this earlier pressure was the pressure that Bridgman had put on it as he had discovered it in his flat anvil apparatus. And so on. Extrapolating upward, I had been to pressures easily of 100,000 atmospheres. Now, I was very cautious at this time in life. I'd been raised as a poor boy, had never had any money, and was always extremely conscientious with regard to the cost of things. I'd see others going pell-mell forward, spending company money all over the place. But I was always very cautious, and this sort of thing did, besides the fact that I was always quite reticent and not forward, delayed a lot of things that I could have done. I was afraid of breaking my expensive tungsten carbide, so I was very conservative in the kind of experiments that I would do. But I did subject graphite in this apparatus to a pressure at one point. Let's see, I probably have the date here. The date of my report is February 27, 1954. Memo report C-54-51, Chemistry Research Department. The title of the report was an attempt to synthesize diamond at 78,000 atmospheres and 2,400 degrees centigrade. Well, it was kind of discouraging, of course, to be able to reach these high pressures. I could have gone above 100,000 atmospheres if I'd wanted to risk my tungsten carbide, but I was afraid they wouldn't buy me anymore. But anyway, at the 78,000 atmospheres, we now know wasn't this high, but even so, it was... Well, let's see, it would have been somewhere around 60,000 atmospheres at any rate. And I could have gone much higher, as I said, if I'd had plenty of tungsten carbide to break. Well, at this point, of course, the thing to do was to go back to chemical systems and see what one might do in the way of finding a catalyst or starting with a material other than graphite to make the diamonds. Now, I tried hundreds of chemical systems as time went on, all sorts of reactions trying to make diamond. It might be interesting to mention at this time that I had learned on a visit to the University of Utah that Loring Coase at the Norton Company had synthesized a new silica mineral, which later came to be known as coasite, at a pressure around 30,000 atmospheres at 700 degrees centigrade or so. On returning back to... I probably mixed up on the date of this. I think I learned this in 1953. Now that I look back, it's when we came out west to the ACS meetings in California on a vacation to Utah in 1953, and talking with Eyring and Kistler at the University of Utah, I learned about this coasite. I immediately went back to the GE lab and put some sodium silicate solution in Bundy's saucer apparatus. It must have been at this point that my half belt was broken and my full belt was not yet constructed, but I made some beautiful crystals of kozite, and no doubt was the second man after Coase first discovered them to make these particular crystals. And in searching for things to put in my device to give me some ideas of pressures that I was achieving, I was always eagerly looking for these. I had been given the data that Coase required something like 32,000 atmospheres and 700 degrees centigrade, and I used this also as a calibration point on my apparatus. Might be well to point out that I was by far the most active person on this diamond project from the time that it was decided that the $150,000 press with the two-stage apparatus was going to be built. The project pretty much fell apart, and it was only because of these ideas that I was pursuing on apparatus that wouldn't require this press that things were kept somewhat active. Bundy was off working on turbine bearings, and Strong was working on P0, so was Bundy working on this at times. And I've already mentioned some of the things that the others of us were doing, but I was the one that was carrying the ball on the Diamond Project. Now, Wentorf was interested in using my device, the belt, and did use it extensively for some period of time, trying out chemical systems, trying to synthesize diamond. Bundy and Strong never did express any interest in the device, other than the fact that Strong seemed to follow along closely behind me in building devices that were similar, yet that he wanted to declare that he had invented independently and were not as similar as they actually were. Well, now, sometime along in what I would guess was late summer of 1954, this gigantic 1,000-ton double-acting press was delivered. It was a monstrous thing. It had to be a special pit built for it in the floor, and then it continued on up for a couple of stories above that floor. Now, it's interesting that Strong and Bundy never did get around to designing that scaled-up version of Bridgman's two-stage piston apparatus. But along in the fall, Strong had built a half belt with my flower pot conical sandwich gasket arrangement. And he was beginning to experiment with this in this huge press that had been delivered. Now, of course, this did not require the double acting principle and could just as well have been used in the old Watson-Stillman press that I'd been using all the time. This device, this half belt that Strong was using, was constructed of steel, and he was experimenting with various systems trying to make diamonds. Now, along in the first part of December, first or second week of December, Strong had put a mixture in of materials known as carburizing compounds. It was some particular brand name of a carburizing compound that did contain carbon, but what else was in it no one would have ever known without a chemical analysis. It was just a trademarked carburizing material used for hardening steels. He had put this in the chamber of this half-belt apparatus at a temperature that he thought was of the order of 1200 degrees centigrade, and had let it stay there overnight in a 16-hour run, as I remember, it was a 13 or 16 hour run. Now, he had put some seed diamonds in this particular device. Now, he had opened his chamber and taken the contents out of this thing, and then had put them on his desk in an open little petri dish that we used to use for holding things, and had let this thing sit there for a week or two open on his desk. Now, along sometime, he must have made the run about the first part of December, but along a week or two later, he decided to analyze this to see if he'd made any diamonds. Well, he took the thing to a lab to have it polished so he could examine it under a microscope, and the polishing wheel had apparently struck something hard, and on fooling around, they found a couple of diamonds in this device, over and above, Strong says, the diamonds that he had put in it. Now, he was going to have these diamonds x-rayed, and Strong's story is that they lost one of the diamonds, but he still had one of them left. Now, this diamond looked, in physical size and general appearance and characteristics, exactly like some diamond chips that we had obtained on a trip that I had made to New York City for use in our experiments. Well, here was a diamond that Strong thought he had synthesized, because he claims that he didn't put any of that kind of diamond in as a seed. He claimed he had put little tiny octahedra in as seeds. Now, you might wonder about the reason for putting seeds in. Well, whenever you grow any crystals, they need to somehow be nucleated. That is, they've got to start to grow somewhere. And very often, a new diamond might start to grow on old diamonds. So that's the reason for putting in diamond seeds. Well, I was very skeptical of this whole business, particularly because the fragment that he had there looked identical to these diamond chips. By the way, I have written a memo on my interesting trip to New York City to buy these particular diamond fragments that we're using as seeds. You might want to read that sometime. It's in my spring-bound notebooks, where I have my various published papers and other bits of information concerning patents and whatnot, as well as some of the GE reports. When this diamond of Strong's was x-rayed, it turned out to be a single crystal. Well, it was hard for me to understand how a single crystal diamond would grow in the irregular shaped splinter that, if you put it with the splinters that we had purchased to use as seeds, would look just exactly like these. Besides, there was some uncertainty in the situation, because Strong had let this thing sit on his desk for such a long period of time. Now, we had the problem of our friends introducing, quote, seeds into the experiments we were doing, and all sorts of hanky-panky of that nature that apparently has gone on since time immemorial in situations where people have been trying to synthesize diamonds. If you read the literature, you'll find out that there are claims that when Moissan thought he made diamonds, that some of his assistants had been playing pranks on him by putting seeds in the mixtures that he was using trying to make diamonds. And we had these seeds here that we were using for the purpose of seeds that others had access to. And I had cases myself where my friends had put diamonds in the material that I had grown. Now, in Strong's mind, he had synthesized diamond, and Bundy and Bovenkirk and Cheney and Neerad and others in the lab all quickly grabbed onto this as being finally a synthesis of diamond. Now, Strong immediately set about to try and duplicate this run without success. Now, just about 1 week later than Strong's decision that he had made diamonds, I made diamonds. Now, the date that I made these diamonds was the 16th of December of 1954. Now, I had been experimenting all this time. In fact, as I have already mentioned, I was the one that was sparking the entire problem. Bundy still had not come back to work on the diamond project at this point. He was still off working on turbine bearings and other problems. Well, on this day, I had taken a clue from nature in another approach to try and make diamonds. In my all-carb alloy belt apparatus, I had a little graphite cylinder which is being used as the heating element and also to supply the graphite to make diamonds. Inside this cylinder of graphite, which was plugged at the ends with graphite, I had placed iron sulfide. This is known as the mineral troilite. I had also placed a little octahedron diamond seed in the near the center, just below the center of this tube. Now, I happened to have it up to just the right pressure and just the right temperature and just the right timing sequence. I had had it at a pressure which at that time was considered to be 95,000 atmospheres. I had held the thing for about 3 minutes and then had slowly lowered temperature and pressure, trying to conserve my anvils, keep them from breaking. I've described all this, the details of the experiment, in the Journal of Chemical Education, so you might want to refer to that paper. But I opened the cell on this day, and the cell just broke open where I cut the glitter of quite a number of little tiny diamonds, and I could see with my naked eye their little triangular faces. Now, I just knew at this instant that I had made diamonds. I was real skeptical that Strong had made diamonds. They'd been working frantically, he and his assistants, during this week, trying to duplicate that run without success. I might mention at this point that they continued to work night and day trying to duplicate that run. And before they were through, they completed over 200 runs in trying to duplicate Strong's run without success. In other words, that run was never duplicated, not even to this day. Yet, the entire management continued to regard that as a synthesis of diamonds, and it was the first synthesis of diamonds that had ever been made. Now, out of the other side of their mouth, later on, the company kept emphasizing that in order to be sure that diamonds had synthesized, you had to be able to duplicate it. Well, to get back to my own run, my own reactions at this point were probably the most unusual that I've ever had in my life. It's difficult to describe them. But I just knew inside that I had made diamonds, and my hands began to tremble, and my knees became weak, and I just had to sit down to get my composure. Now, when I had regained my composure, and I judge it was 10 minutes before I did, I went upstairs where there was a microscope and looked at these beautiful little crystals under a microscope, and they had all the facial characteristics of diamond. Now, I might mention that these didn't look at all like the diamond that Strong had said he synthesized. You couldn't see a triangular face, which is characteristic of diamond growth, anywhere on Strong's diamond. It looked like a diamond splinter, identical to these things that we had been using occasionally for diamond seeds, in which I had purchased some carrots of some time before. In this connection, it's interesting to note that
later on. Many pictures of Strong's diamond alongside of a diamond phonograph needle were shown. This was shown in the original publicity and whatnot. Now, I had a fellow tell me from Christensen Diamond Tool Company. I became acquainted with these fellows somewhat later after I moved to Brigham Young University.